Many women feel that rape can't happen to them. But one out of every three women in this country will be sexually assaulted during her lifetime. As a matter of fact, one out of four females and one out of 11 males will be assaulted before the age of 18 years old. And we have to compare this with the fact that there is only a 4% conviction rate of rapists. Rape happens anywhere, anytime, to women of all ages. And the rape of an infant as young as 4 months old has been documented. And many women over the age of 90 have been raped. Rape happens to women of all ages, all races, all classes. It happens to disabled women. It happens to women regardless of their sexual preference.
A controversial woman speaks on a controversial subject. Tonight on Alternative Views. Many people have heard and read about Angela Davis, but few of us have had the opportunity to hear Angela Davis speak. Dr. Davis is professor of women's studies at San Francisco State University, and in February 1985, she gave a speech at San Diego State University. The subject of the presentation was the anti-rape movement and the struggle against racism. Robin King made a videotape of the speech, and we present it to you tonight.
Black History Month, and it is important that we take note of the history of the contributions of African Americans. I think it's very appropriate that I've been asked to speak this evening on the anti-rape movement and the struggle against racism. The contemporary anti-rape movement began to take shape during the early 70s, shortly after the crystallization of the women's liberation movement. At that time, there were very few black women, very few women of color associated with the anti-rape movement, indeed associated with the women's liberation movement. And I want to talk later on about some of the problematic dynamics that resulted directly from racism within the women's movement. But first, I want to talk about some of the very positive results of the anti-rape movement as it emerged during the early 1970s. It was in January of 1971 that in New York, the New York radical feminists organized a rape speak out. And for the very first time, women began to speak publicly about an experience which so many of them had been compelled to hide before. In 1971, also in Berkeley, women who were conscious of the treatment that rape survivors were experiencing decided to start a community-based 24-hour rape crisis line, which was known as Bay Area Women Against Rape. The organization, of course, continues to exist today. And as a matter of fact, associated with the Bay Area Women Against Rape is a Black Women's Anti-Violence Project. It used to be the case, and unfortunately in many instances it still is, that rape is seen by, according to prevailing social attitudes, as something that is precipitated or invited by women who are raped. Women ask for it. Thus, in the words of one study, female hitchhikers who accept rides, women who allow ourselves to be driven home from a social event, women who answer our front doors in dressing gowns, leave windows open, take walks at night, drink with strangers in public places, or act in any number of ways that would be acceptable if they were done by a man, have precipitated any violence or assault that then occurs. And of course, some of you may remember some years ago in 1977 in Wisconsin, a judge found that a 15-year-old male's rape of a teenager who had been wearing a loose shirt, Levi's, and tennis shoes was a, quote, normal reaction to the, quote, provocative dress of the young woman. Eventually, this judge was removed as a result of a movement that was organized in the community. Many women feel that rape can't happen to them. But one out of every three women in this country will be sexually assaulted during her lifetime. As a matter of fact, one out of four females and one out of 11 males will be assaulted before the age of 18 years old. And we have to compare this with the fact that there is only a 4% conviction rate of rapists. Rape happens anywhere, anytime, to women of all ages, and the rape of an infant as young as 4 months old has been documented, and many women over the age of 90 have been raped. Rape happens to women of all ages, all races, all classes. It happens to disabled women. It happens to women regardless of their sexual preference. Over half of all the rapes that occur in the home of either the rape survivor or the offender. And oftentimes we have this image of the rapist as being someone who's going to jump out of the bushes. And generally, when that image is conjured up, it is that of a black man who's going to jump out of the bushes. But over half of all rapes occur in the home. Most men, as a matter of fact, who rape know their victims. Most men know the women they rape. Another myth about rape is that it is an act of lust. That rapists somehow are men who are unable to control their sexual desires. But most men don't rape in order to satisfy a sexual desire. Most men do not rape impulsively in order to satisfy a sexual desire. Most rapists are not psychopaths. Most rapists are, quote, normal males. And before the end of my presentation, I want to perhaps raise some questions about what it is that motivates so many men to rape in this society. Perhaps the most insidious myth about rape is that it is most likely to be committed by a black man. White women are socialized as a result of the pervasive racism in our society to experience far more fear that they will be raped by a black man than a white man. But there are many more rapes committed by white men than by black men, or Chicano men, or Native American Indian men. It is the case, however, that most men who are in prison, who have been convicted of rape charges, are black. The vast majority of white men who rape get away with it for any number of reasons. Over 90% of all rapes that occur are intraracial, not interracial. But of course, the myth of the black rapist. And of course, black men rape. However, the stereotypical image of the black man as rapist has constituted one of the most dangerous ideological weapons of racism since the end of the Civil War. And as a matter of fact, has served to prevent the most effective movement against rape. Because if you don't understand who's doing the raping, how can you fight them? And if you think most rapes are being committed by black men or Chicano men, rather than by doctors or professors or judges. But of course, these are the kind of men who don't generally end up going to court on a rape charge, and certainly don't end up in the penitentiary. As far as black women are concerned, there is a very close relationship between the rape of black women by white men and the fraudulent charges of rape often leveled against black men. But before I talk a little bit about the historical background of the myth of the black rapist on the one hand and the use of rape as a weapon of terror against black women on the other, I want to recall the facts of a case that occurred. Some of you may remember, some of you may be too young to remember. It was in the year 1975, a very celebrated case involving a woman who had been raped. And that was the case of Joanne Little. In August of 1975, a white jailer in a little town in North Carolina, in Beaufort County, was found stabbed to death. He was naked from the waist down. And he was in the cell of a prisoner who was missing. Joanne Little, the prisoner who was missing, later turned herself in, and she was charged with first-degree murder. She explained the events which had led her to stab the jailer with an ice pick and then flee afterwards by describing the fact that this man had come into her cell. He was the jailer, and this was incidentally a men's jail where they had placed Joanne Little, who had been convicted on charges of breaking and entering. He had entered her cell with an ice pick, which he, for some reason or another, kept in his drawer. And he had used the ice pick in order to force her to submit to the rape that he inflicted upon her. However, she managed to get a hold of the ice pick and stabbed him a number of times and killed him. Having killed him, she became very frightened and fled the jail. Of course, there's a long history of black women being sexually abused in the way that Joanne Little was abused. Joanne Little had not only been raped, but prior to the rape, there had been a television camera focused on her cell all the time while she was dressing or while she was taking a shower. On one occasion, she had tried to cover up the camera with her sheets, but then her sheets were taken away from her, so she had no sheets to sleep on in her cell. On another occasion, a highway patrolman had come into her jail cell on business that was totally unrelated to Joanne's case and had urinated on the floor. However, it was Joanne Little who was called upon to bear the responsibility for all that had gone down. She was charged with murder in the first degree. And she would have been convicted. She would have been convicted had not it been for the fact that a movement, a tremendous movement of national scope, as a matter of fact, women in other countries became involved in that movement. There were petitions, there were telegrams and letters sent to the judge and the prosecutor. And finally, when the trial took place, she was found not guilty. One of the things that we had to deal with in that trial, and I was involved in that trial, having just, well, a couple of years earlier, concluded a trial myself. As you know, Tony mentioned, I was charged with murder also. As a matter of fact, I was charged with three capital crimes. So I assisted the defense in preparing Joanne for her testimony and in preparing the defense that was given in the courtroom, as well as working to build the mass movement, the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression, of which I was and still am a co-chairperson, took that case on as one of our priority cases. And so we had to talk about the history of the use of rape as a weapon of terror against black women. That history goes all the way back to slavery. As a matter of fact, rape was as much a weapon of repression used against the slave community as was the whip and the lash and all of the other paraphernalia of repression. Black women were systematically sexually abused. It was assumed that the slave master and all of his agents, all of his white agents, had access to the bodies of all of the black women in the slave community. And if you look at the way many of us black folks look today, you can understand the degree to which this was so extensive. I mean, why do you think that we look the way we look? Between 1865 and 1895 alone, some 10,000 documented rapes occurred, as reported by Ida Wells, who, when in her community in Memphis, Tennessee, Ida B. Wells, of course, how many of you all know Ida B. Wells, since this is Black History Month? Ida B. Wells is one of the great figures of our history, and as a result of the combined racism and sexism that generally characterize orthodox histories, her name is known by only a few people. Ida Wells was a newspaper woman who lived in Memphis, Tennessee. She had started her own newspaper, the Memphis Free Speech. When a rape occurred in her community, rather, I'm sorry, a lynching occurred in her community, three men whom she knew personally were lynched. The circumstances surrounding that lynching were very simple. These men, black men, had opened up a grocery store in the black community. And black people started to go to the black grocery store as opposed to the white grocery store that had been operating in the black community. And those of us who are, you know, from the South know that virtually the only presence of white people in our communities were, you know, those who operated the grocery stores, the corner stores, the candy stores. I know for a long time those were the only white people I ever came into contact with when I lived in Birmingham, Alabama. But in any event, these three men bought and began to operate a grocery store, bringing business away from the white grocery store. The white men picked a fight with the black men. The black men knocked out some of the white men. They were arrested, and then a mob broke them out of the jail and strung them up on trees at the edge of town. So when this happened, it enlightened Ida B. Wells about the nature of the ideological justification of lynching that had been virtually accepted not only by white people but by some black people as well. That somehow or another black men were lynched because they were at least accused of, even if they were not guilty, at least accused of sexually assaulting a white woman. There was an incident in which they had absolutely nothing to do with even the accusation of rape. So she began to use her newspaper as a way in which to speak out against rape, which led to threats on her life. As a matter of fact, Ida Wells had to operate for a long time her newspaper offices with a gun on her hip. That's the kind of woman she was. She did research, and she discovered that only about 16% of all of those lynchings even involved the accusation of rape. Whereas most people were under the impression that this is why lynchings occurred, even though they might have been opposed to the lynchings, they felt that however horrible lynching was, rape was also horrible, so they could understand how men could be motivated to lynch as a result of the rape of white women. But this isn't what lynching was about at all. As a matter of fact, the myth of the black rapist was conjured up precisely in order to justify attempts to prevent black people from moving forward in the aftermath of the Civil War in the struggle for liberation and equality. Ida Wells was responsible for the creation of a tremendous crusade against lynching. As a matter of fact, she single-handedly built the earliest forms of the anti-lynching movement. But what's important about that movement is the relationship it bore to the struggle against rape. Because Ida Wells motivated black women to become involved in the fight against lynching and simultaneously to defend black women who were victims of rape, sexual abuse, and who were represented as immoral, as promiscuous, as whores. The Black Women's Club movement, which emerged, and some of you know who know a little bit about the history of the Black Women's Club movement, will agree that they accomplished incredible feats. But what's important is that these women organized what was perhaps the first organized challenge to rape and sexual abuse in this country. Women like Ida Wells, Mary Church Terrell, Josephine St. Pierre Ruffin, and they understood the relationship between the portrayal of black women as immoral, as promiscuous, as bland, as bad, the relationship between that ideological image and the image of black men as rapists. And they challenged those two ideological images simultaneously. I mention this because in the black community, these two things have always been linked together. And if when the anti-rape movement initially emerged in the early 70s, black women were reluctant to associate themselves with that movement, it was because our historical experience had dictated a different approach to the fight against rape. And of course, it was not that we did not want to see an end to rape, not by any stretch of the imagination. But some of the early tactics that were set forth within the anti-rape movement involved such approaches as longer prison terms for rapists, calling upon the police to deal more strongly with rape. And while, of course, these things are important out of the context of understanding the impact that racism has had on rape and on the fraudulent use of the rape charge, for this reason, many black women shied away from the anti-rape movement. As a matter of fact, I remember finding it very difficult to support a movement that would, in an isolated fashion, simply demand longer prison terms. Because I knew that those men who were going to be getting those longer prison terms were going to be black men, some of them guilty, but some of them innocent as well. Because it's, at least in the past, it was generally the case that if only a woman cried rape, that was enough to cause the conviction and sometimes the execution of black men. The Scottsboro Nine, for example, who were in prison for years and years. From the late 1920s, as a matter of fact, the last surviving member of the Scottsboro Nine was only pardoned by the governor of Alabama in 1982, I think it was. And this case occurred in 1929. when 9 young black men were on a freight train and 2 white women got into the freight train also in Scottsboro, Alabama. And if anybody knows anything about Alabama, then or even now, you can understand that when the doors to the freight car were opened and officials noticed that there were 9 black men and 2 white women together alone in a freight train, that the men were going to pay for that. And so pressure was put on the women to charge that they had been raped. And it was years before the women finally admitted that they had not been raped, but rather that they had been told to accuse these young men with rape. Well, that's one case. There were many, many, many other cases similar to that. So that black women in the early 70s, first of all, felt that an anti-rape movement also had to challenge the racist use of the fraudulent rape charge. Black women were also leery about dealing with the police at that time. And I, as a matter of fact, I can remember when I was a student at the University of California in San Diego, I remember an incident that occurred that I never forgot. I was driving down the freeway, as a matter of fact, right here in San Diego, with a friend, and we saw a young black woman who had been beaten on the side of the freeway, and we stopped and picked her up, and she told the most incredible story. She had been raped. She had been raped by a group of white men who had just dropped her off. The police had picked her up and had raped her again. And as a matter of fact, during the civil rights movement in the South, police routinely raped black women who were involved in the movement. That was a means of asserting, of attempting to assert their power. That was their way of saying that we do not want the system of segregation to be shaken up. So you can imagine that black women would find it rather difficult to become involved in programs that relied on the police when they saw the police as perpetrators. Right after Joanne Little's trial was over, she appealed to all of the people, and especially women across the country who had supported her, to support a man by the name of Delbert Tibbs, who was on death row in Florida. He was on death row in Florida because he had been falsely accused and convicted of raping a white woman. The evidence in this was so blatant, the exculpatory evidence, the evidence that should have led to his acquittal, was so blatant. However, if, again, you know anything about the South and about towns like Fort Myers, Florida, you can understand that regardless of that, he was convicted because they could not find the man who had committed the rape. A rape had been committed, and by a black man, according to the woman. And of course, black men rape. Yeah, black men rape, and black men should be punished when they rape. But just because black men rape does not mean that all black men rape. And so Delbert Tibbs was in a situation where he was very vulnerable. He wasn't from the state. He was hitchhiking. And when they couldn't find the rapist, they picked him up and framed him up, did an incredible job of framing him up. And although he did not in any way resembled the person described by the woman. The woman had described an older man who was dark-skinned, who had a pockmarked complexion. Delbert Tibbs is light-skinned, a much younger man. As a matter of fact, during the trial, and this is in the transcript itself, during the trial, when they tried to explain the discrepancies between the original description and the way Delbert Tibbs looked, one of the jailers testified that Delbert Tibbs had not been in the sun for many months. And that is why he was light instead of dark. And this was accepted by the jury. But what was important about that particular case was that the man who had committed the rape and had been described by the woman and to have been driving a green pickup truck apparently went on and committed four rapes, because a similar man was found to be in jail in another state. And the prosecution learned about this. But you see, by that time, there was such hysteria in the community around Delbert Tibbs that they did not want to stop midstream and go and charge someone else, because everybody was convinced that Delbert Tibbs was the rapist. So the prosecutor did not even question this other man. And to this day, this man has never been questioned about that case. His existence was discovered by an investigative reporter who went in and talked to him and discovered that the man had a green pickup truck, exactly as had been described by the woman in the case. And I make this point because if we don't understand the function of racism, we can't clearly understand how to go about challenging rape and eventually eliminating it. And of course, we can argue that it's important to learn self-defense. Yes, self-defense is very important. Because oftentimes, as women, we tend not to be aware of our own capabilities. And rather than stand up, and I'm not saying stand up to someone who has a knife, you know, at your throat, but sometimes, being able to confidently and physically deal with the man who's about to rape you can make a difference. I can remember some years ago there was a rapist terrorizing the community in Berkeley. And my sister lives in that area. And she was, I think, at that time, a law student studying at Bolt Hall in Berkeley. And, well, she never closes her, locks her door anyway. And I still have to tell her to lock her door, because every time I go over to her house, the door is open. But during this time, she was studying, she was in her study, she was living with alone with her daughter, and she looked up and there was this man who had just walked into the house and was standing over her. So she stood up and looked at him and said, "What the fuck are you doing in my house?" And as a matter of fact, she went for him. The man ran out of the house. She chased him down the street. And if she had been able to run a little faster, would have caught. And so that can make a difference, and that is important. However, there are some underlying social reasons why rape is so all-pervasive that we have to understand if we want eventually to purge this society of the scourge of rape. And those underlying social forces have to do with the fact that we live in a monopoly capitalist society that thrives on racism, that thrives on sexism, that uses the domination of women for all kinds of reasons, for super profits, among other things. The fact that women barely make 60% of what men earn is an example of how advantageous sexism is to certain sectors of this society, namely the larger corporate forces. And of course, when you combine that with racism, women of color earn 50-some-odd% of what white men earn. And when you consider that there is no concern whatever by the forces that are economically ascendant in this society about women's welfare, there is no child care system in this country, as there should be. There should be a free, universally accessible child care system so that women who want to work will have the ability to work. But we live in a society in which poor women and a good number of those women are women of color, are now not able to determine the size of their families because abortion is not accessible to them. As a result of the 1977 Hyde Amendment, federal funds have been withdrawn. So even the discussion about the right to abortion is a moot discussion for a lot of women who don't have the money to pay for abortions and therefore cannot enjoy that right. But when you consider that at the same time, sterilizations are covered by the federal government, the defunding of abortions did not touch sterilizations. So that so many women who, for financial reasons now, cannot afford to have a baby and might want to sometime in the future, they are often compelled to be surgically sterilized. You know, not that the right to sterilization is not important, but we're talking about sterilization abuse. Affirmative action is under attack for women and for people of color. We don't even have a civil rights commission anymore to speak of, because it's just a rubber stamp agency for the president. There is, of course, a further effort to prevent students who come from working class backgrounds from getting an education, because Reagan's talking about slashing the budget even further as far as scholarships are concerned. And as a matter of fact, education ought to be free in this society. Yeah. Not only should education be free, but students should be paid. So we live in a society where there is tremendous unemployment. So when you graduate, you may go straight from the commencement line to the unemployment line. 16% of the black population is unemployed officially. And you see, they don't even count those who've been looking for jobs so long that they are discouraged. They are not even counted as a part of the unemployed figures. And yet Ronald Reagan was reelected. That was strange, wasn't it? But it speaks to the fact that the demagogic manner that in which Reagan conducts himself was quite effective, because most people who voted for Ronald Reagan really were not voting for Reagan's policies. As a matter of fact, many of the people who voted for Reagan turned around and also voted for a nuclear freeze, because they thought that Reagan, because at the last minute, you know, he said that he was in favor of negotiations with the Soviet Union. This is a very confused world right now. But since this is Black History Month, I'd like to point out the fact that Black people certainly weren't confused during the last election. And as has been the case so often in the history of this country, leadership, the most progressive leadership, has come from the Black community. And I'm not saying this because to be boasting, because that really doesn't concern me. What I'm interested in is how we're going to get out of this mess that we find ourselves in. And we cannot understand the whole process of challenging rape outside of this larger context. If something is wrong that is motivating so many men to rape so many women, something is wrong with this whole damn system. Point out that it's not the case that in every country today, not even in every developed industrial society, that rape is so epidemic. As a matter of fact, I can remember a couple of years ago visiting the German Democratic Republic in Berlin, and I could not believe that women walked around through parks alone at night, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, at first I thought they were sort of bold. Well, you know, I do things like that, but I'm, somewhat bold myself. Besides, I also know self-defense, so and I've had to use it. But seriously speaking, I remember asking a woman who I came to know when I was there, who was a professor at the university there, about her experiences in West Berlin, because she does a lot of traveling to the West, West Berlin and England and so forth. And she says that she always has to be reminded that she can't walk through a park in the middle of the night. And she said she never grew up with that fear. It just does not characterize the socialist society in which she lives. But if one looks at the overall position of women, one finds that women in general are not vulnerable the way women are in this society. Women do not receive lower pay. Women are not stuck in the dead-end jobs that they're stuck in this country. Everyone has the right to maternity leave, for example. All women have the right to 24-hour child care. So I'd like to throw this out for you to consider. I think that there's something about capitalism that is encouraging this epidemic. And while, of course, I would not argue that we have to wait until the revolution comes to do anything about rape, I think we have to place the struggle against rape within that larger context. And those of us who are involved in rape crisis and rape prevention should try to keep the larger perspective in mind. And speaking of the larger perspective, I'd like to conclude my presentation by saying that, in general, what is needed in this country today is togetherness, is unity. People of my age are often associated with the struggles of the 60s. Well, we need to build a movement the likes of which were not even seen during the 1960s right now. And I think the possibility for building that movement is there. If you look at how quickly the whole struggle for a free South Africa has swept this country, where hundreds and hundreds of people have been arrested. There are demonstrations going on daily outside of the South African embassy, outside of all of the South African consulates, outside of South African tourist agencies, jewelers that carry Krugerrands are in the process of being boycotted. Workers, longshore workers in the Bay Area recently refused to unload cargo from South Africa. And I just read recently that the businessmen in South Africa said that they wanted to give apartheid a second thought. because what's happening is that city after city, university campus, as a result of the pressure that is being placed upon them, are deciding to withdraw their investments from corporations that have subsidiaries or branches in South Africa. And the results of that movement are being seen. Well, I think that this can act as a stimulus for the development of mass movements in this country, the further development. I shouldn't say the development because the movements are still there. They're just not as large as they need to be. They're just not as powerful as they need to be. If ever we needed to take to the streets before my sisters and my brothers, we need to fill the streets with our massive demonstrations today. Demonstrations involving coalitions of workers, people of color, the women's movement, the lesbian and gay movement, the disabled movement, the seniors movement, the youth movement, the peace movement. If ever we needed to struggle together before, we need to struggle together today. This is our only guarantee that we will be able to join hands and walk together on a path that will lead us beyond the fascist potential that's so evident in this society, beyond the possibility of nuclear omnicide that has become so apparent with the re-election of Ronald Reagan. We need to walk together in solidarity with the people of Nicaragua and El Salvador and the people of South Africa. Together toward a world that will eventually be free of racism, of anti-Semitism, of economic exploitation, a world in which women will have truly achieved emancipation, a world in which the threat of nuclear war will have become a horrible nightmare of the past, finally laid to rest. Thank you.
Robin King for sending us the tape of Angela Davis. Alternative Views is a presentation of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713.
I've been waiting for something to happen, for a week or a month or a year, with the blood in the ink of the headline and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before. Where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the truth to the wars that are fought in places where their business interests run. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments are killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun, or a brick, or a stone, and there are lies in the balance.
They're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lies in the balance.